All right, so buckle up, everyone, because today we are diving headfirst into a legal case that I think you'll find really fascinating.
Yeah, this one is a real doozy.
It is. It is. It's the case of Ford Motor Credit Company versus Russell. And, I mean, who doesn't love a good car story, right?
Oh, absolutely. Cars, contracts, consumer law, repossession, we've got it all in this one.
We really do. This case is like a crash course, no pun intended, in how the worlds of advertising, consumer expectations, and the, you know, the cold hard reality of the legal system all kind of smash together.
Yeah, and you know what? Even though this case happened a while ago, the lessons we can learn from it are still super relevant today, especially if you're, you know, thinking about buying a car or if you're just curious about how contract law and consumer protection actually play out in real life situations.
Exactly. We're going to break it all down for you. So I guess to set the stage here, we need to go back in time a bit.
Right. Fire up the time machine.
Back to the late 1980s. Picture this. Monticello Ford, a dealership in Minnesota, puts out an ad for a, get this, a 1988 Ford Escort Pony.
Well,
a classic.
Oh, yeah. A real beauty.
Yeah.
And the advertised price, are you ready for this? $7,826.
Not bad.
Not bad at all, especially for the time. And of course, the ad mentions financing because, you know, who pays cash for a car these days, right?
Yeah.
So enter Dawn Russell, our protagonist in this story.
Sure.
She sees this ad, thinks, hey, that's a pretty sweet deal, and heads down to the dealership ready to, you know, drive off in her new, well, new to her, Ford Escort.
Sounds good so far.
Right. But here's where things take a bit of a turn. When she gets there, the dealership offers her an interest rate of 13.75%.
Oof, a little steep.
Yeah, a little higher than she probably had in mind. And on top of that, they tell her she needs a cosigner because of her credit history. And guess who that lucky cosigner is? Her dad.
Dad to the rescue, or maybe not so much in this case?
Well, we'll see about that. So she ends up financing the car for a little more than the advertised price, $8,275.60 to be exact. All right, so not quite the deal she thought she was getting.
Not exactly, but, you know, she's got the car, she's making her payments, everything seems to be, you know, moving along.
Until,
yeah, there's always an until in these stories. So a little while later, Dawn decides to cancel some of the optional insurance she'd added to the loan, you know, credit disability insurance, an extended service contract, that kind of thing.
Okay, makes sense. Maybe she was trying to save some money.
Yeah, probably. And the money from those cancellations gets applied to her loan balance, so that's good, right?
Seems like it.
But, and here's the big but, she eventually defaults on her loan payments. And this is where Ford Motor Credit steps in and says, all right, time to repossess this car. And they end up selling it at auction for a measly $2,200.
Wow. That's quite a drop.
Right. And of course, they then sue Dawn to recover the remaining balance on the loan.
Okay, so this is where the legal battle really heats up.
Oh, yeah. This is where it gets good. The Russells, they weren't just going to take this lying down. They came back swinging with a whole bunch of legal arguments.
Let's hear them.
All right. So first off, they claimed that the advertisement itself was a binding contract. And Ford, by not honoring the advertised price and terms, had breached that contract.
Interesting. So their argument is that the ad wasn't just, you know, marketing fluff. It was a concrete offer that Dawn accepted when she went to the dealership.
Exactly. And this gets to the heart of a really fundamental question in contract law. When does an advertisement actually become a legally binding offer?
Yeah, I mean, we see ads all the time. Are we entering into a contract every time we see a price tag or a special offer?
Right. So to figure this out, the court in this case, they had to dive deep into the, you know, the nitty gritty of contract law. And they looked at a lot of previous cases, including a really famous one, Carlyle versus Carbolic Smokeball Company.
Oh, that's a classic. Smokeball case. I bet everyone listening who's taken a contracts class remembers that one.
Oh, yeah. It's a good one. So for those who might not remember or haven't gotten to it in their studies yet, in that case, this company, they were selling this smoke ball thing, and they claimed that if you used it, you wouldn't get the flu, and if you did get sick, they'd pay you £100. And to show they were serious, they actually deposited £1,000 in the bank, like, we're good for it.
Wow, they were confident.
Right. And this woman, Mrs. Carlyle, she used the smoke ball, still got the flu, and sued to get her £100.
Did she win?
She did. The court said that the ad was so specific and the company had shown such clear intent to be bound by its promise that it actually created a legally enforceable contract. So Mrs. Carlyle got her money.
So how did that apply to the Ford case?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, right?
Right.
The court had to figure out if the Ford ad was similar enough to the Smokeball ad to be considered a binding offer, too.
And what did they decide?
They said, nope, not quite the same. The Ford ad, it just didn't have that same level of, you know, clear and definite commitment that the Smokeball ad did. It didn't say, like, guaranteed price for everyone no matter what. And think about it. What if the dealership only had one of those Escorts in stock? Could they really be forced to sell it to everyone who saw the ad at that price?
Yeah, that wouldn't make much business sense.
Right. And plus, ad mentioned financing. But, you know, financing always depends on an individual's credit history. The court said it wouldn't be reasonable to expect a dealership to be locked into specific financing terms for absolutely everyone, regardless of their creditworthiness.
So the court basically said the Ford ad was more like an invitation to come in and talk, not a, you know, take it or leave it offer.
Exactly. They were like, here's a car, here's a possible price, come on down and let's chat.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what was the Russells' next argument?
All right, so their second probe of attack was the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or ETCOA for short.
Ah, yes, the ECOA, a big one in consumer lending.
Huge. The Russells argued that Ford Credit violated the ECOA by requiring Dawn to have her father co-sign the loan. They said this is discriminatory.
Okay, so we're getting into the world of fair lending practices now.
Exactly. The ECOA, it's all about preventing discrimination in credit transactions. You can't deny someone credit based on things like their race, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, age, you know, all those protected characteristics.
Right, that makes sense. But lenders also need to be able to assess risk, right? They can't be forced to loan money to people who are very likely to default.
Absolutely. And the law recognizes that. Lenders are allowed to consider an applicant's creditworthiness when making lending decisions. So Ford Credit, they argued that requiring a cosigner wasn't about discrimination. It was purely about Dawn's limited credit history. And they had some pretty strong evidence to back that up.
Like what?
Well, they showed that Dawn had actually been denied credit by two other finance companies. And get this, even with her father as a cosigner.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't just Ford being picky.
Nope. She was considered a credit risk by multiple lenders. So the court, they sided with Ford Credit on this one. They said there was no evidence that the cosigner requirement was motivated by anything other than legitimate concerns about Dawn's ability to repay the loan.
So the takeaway here is that while the EKOA protects you from being unfairly denied credit, it doesn't guarantee you a loan just because you want one.
Right. Lenders are allowed to and should assess risk based on objective factors like your credit history. And if your credit score isn't great, you might need a cosigner to help you get that loan.
Fair enough. What's next on the Russell's list of grievances?
Okay, so their next argument revolved around the Truth in Lending Act, also known as TILA.
TILA, another big one in consumer credit.
Oh, yeah. This is a cornerstone of consumer protection when it comes to loans. Basically, TILA requires lenders to be upfront and transparent about all the costs associated with a loan. They have to disclose things like the annual percentage rate or APR, the total finance charge, the payment schedule, all that stuff in a way that's clear and easy for the borrower to understand.
Makes sense. Consumers need to know what they're getting into.
Exactly. So the Russells, they focused on what happened when Dawn canceled those optional insurance policies. Remember, the credit disability insurance and the extended service contract.
Right. And the premiums were applied to reduce her loan balance.
Right. So their argument was that canceling those policies and adjusting the loan balance, that essentially created a whole new credit agreement. And because it was a new agreement, Ford Credit should have provided Dawn with a whole new set of TILA disclosures.
Interesting. So they're saying it wasn't just a minor tweak to the existing loan. It was essentially a refi.
Exactly. And the specific regulation that governs TILA compliance, it's called Regulation Z, and it lays out all the rules about when new disclosures are required. So the question for the court was, did canceling those insurance policies trigger a new disclosure requirement under Regulation Z?
And what did they say?
The court sided with Ford Credit on this one, too. They said canceling the insurance and applying those premiums to the loan, it was just an adjustment to the existing agreement, not a brand new loan or a refi. And the key factor for them was that the fundamental terms of the original loan, the interest rate, and the original repayment schedule, those stayed exactly the same.
So the lesson here is that not every change to your loan will trigger a mountain of new paperwork and disclosures.
Right. If the core terms of your loan, the interest rate and your monthly payment amount, if those stay the same, then things like prepayments or canceling extra services might not require a whole new set of TILA disclosures.
Okay, that makes sense. So what was the Russell's next line of attack?
All right, this one gets a little more specific to Minnesota law. The Russells, they brought up the Minnesota Motor Vehicle Retail Installment Sales Act. That's a mouthful, so everyone just calls it MVRS.
MVRS, got it. Another consumer protection law.
Yep, this one focuses specifically on car financing. And one of the things MVRS does is it requires that all retail installment sales for vehicles have to be documented in a clear written agreement that spells out all the terms and conditions.
Okay, that makes sense. Protects both the buyer and the seller.
Exactly. So the Russells, their argument here was that when Don canceled that insurance, that essentially created a brand new contract under MVRSA.
So similar to their TILA argument, they're saying it wasn't just a modification, it was a whole new deal.
Exactly. And because it was a new deal, they said Ford Credit should have drawn up a new written agreement to comply with MVRSA.
Did the court buy that argument?
They did not. The court said, look, there's a difference between making a minor modification to an existing contract and completely overhauling the core terms of the deal. Canceling the insurance, it did affect the outstanding balance, sure, but it didn't change the fundamental elements of the original agreement. The price of the car, the interest rate, the payment schedule, those all remained the same.
So the court said it was more like an amendment to the original contract, not a completely new one.
Exactly. And because it was just a modification, they said a new written agreement wasn't required under MVRSA.
Okay, makes sense. So what about the final issue, the repossession sale?
Yes, the final showdown. So the Russells, they challenged whether the auction sale of the repossessed Ford Escort for $2,200 was commercially reasonable. And this brings us to the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, which, you know, governs all sorts of commercial transactions, including the sale of repossessed collateral.
Yeah, the UCC is a big deal in the business world.
Huge. And there's a specific section, UCC section 9610B, that requires that when a lender repossesses and sells collateral, they have to do it in a commercially reasonable manner.
Okay, so what does commercially reasonable actually mean in this context?
It basically means the lender has to make a good faith effort to get a fair price for the repossessed item. They can't just, you know, give it away to their buddy for a dollar.
Right, that wouldn't be fair to the borrower who still owes money on the loan.
Exactly. The idea is that by selling the collateral for a decent price, the lender can reduce the amount of the deficiency, which is the amount the borrower still owes after the sale.
So how did Ford Credit measure up to this commercially reasonable standard?
Well, they sold the car through a dealer auction, which is a pretty standard way of selling used cars.
Yeah, dealer auctions are a recognized marketplace for that kind of thing.
Exactly. And the UCC specifically mentions selling collateral in a recognized market as a method that's generally considered to be commercially reasonable. In fact, there's a presumption that if a sale happens in a recognized market, it was done in a commercially reasonable way.
So the burden of proof kind of shifts to the borrower to show that something fishy happened.
Right. So the Russells, their main argument was that the $2,200 sale price was just too low. They said it wasn't a fair reflection of the car's actual value.
But the court didn't agree.
They didn't. The court said, look, a low price by itself isn't enough to prove that a sale wasn't commercially reasonable, especially when, you know, the sale happened at a dealer auction, which is, like we said, a recognized market.
So what would the Russells have had to do to win on this point?
They would have needed to show that there was something wrong with the auction process itself. Like if the auction wasn't properly advertised, or if potential buyers were unfairly excluded, or if there was some other problem that prevented the car from fetching a fair price.
So it's not just about the final price, it's about the process leading up to the sale.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And because the Russells couldn't point to any specific flaws in the auction process, the court upheld the sale as commercially reasonable.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. What are the big takeaways from this case?
All right, let's recap. First, when it comes to advertising, most ads are just invitations to negotiate, not ironclad contracts. Unless the ad makes some super specific, can't-miss promises, don't assume you can hold a company to every word.
Right. It's more like the opening move in a chess game, not checkmate.
Exactly. Second, lenders are allowed to consider your creditworthiness when deciding whether to give you a loan. And if your credit history is a bit shaky, they can require you to have a cosigner. That's not necessarily discrimination under the ECOA. It's just good business sense.
It's about balancing consumer protection with, you know, the reality of lending risk.
Right. Third, if you prepay your loan or cancel extra services, don't expect to be bombarded with a whole new set of TILA disclosures as long as the core terms of your loan, the interest rate, and your payment schedule stay the same.
It's about making sure you understand the initial deal, not every little change along the way.
Right. Fourth, minor modifications to your car loan agreement, like canceling optional insurance, probably won't be considered a brand new contract under Minnesota law. And finally, if your car gets repossessed, the lender has to sell it in a way that's commercially reasonable, which often means using standard industry practices like dealer auctions. And even if the sale price seems low, it's probably going to be considered okay as long as the lender followed a fair process.
So, a lot of good lessons here about contracts, consumer protection, and the UCC in action.
Absolutely. And it makes you think, how do these principles apply in today's world? I mean, think about all the online car buying that's happening now and all the complexities of digital lending.
Yeah, it's a whole new ballgame in some ways.
It is. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Ford Motor Credit versus Russell, I think the big question for all of us is, how do these legal concepts that we've been talking about, how do they fit into the rapidly evolving landscape of online commerce and digital finance?
Yeah, that's something to ponder.
It is. It makes you think about the balance of power between businesses and consumers in the digital age and the role of the law in trying to level the playing field.
Definitely. And I think this case highlights the importance of understanding these fundamental legal principles, no matter how you're buying or financing a car, or really anything else for that matter.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, that's our deep dive for today. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.